Let's take up the point that I just made, and that is that there are some folk who still don't understand the meaning of glory. I'm sure that's not so. I'm sure that within all of us there's the echo every time we see glory. When you see a lovely sunset, I'm sure most of us are moved by the beautiful and brilliant colours. When we see what we call creation in all its forms, whether it's in the sea or in the land or in the air, we see glory of a kind. The psalm tells us that that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork. But that glory that you see is not the glory of God himself. That is the way in which his glory is manifested. And we need to get hold of that fact, because some people don't respond to a sunset for various reasons. Are best known to themselves, I suppose, but we respond to glory when we come to a human being and we see that what we said, the Greek idea, which is really not only a Greek idea, of the beauty of the physical form of human beings, and particularly when they're using those gifts of body in sport, in running, in Olympics, in all kinds of things. When we hear beautiful singing, and we appreciate the fact of the singer, we think, what a glorious song that is, what a glorious person that is when she's singing. I don't know what she's like when she's not singing, because I'm not married to her. But there are times when that glory is a very special gift that manifests itself in certain ways. And then I think all of us, they were trying to surf around to find out who's the greatest person of the 19th century. And then, of course, you have your local situations, who's the greatest sport or athlete or whatever in that particular century and so on. And there are great people whose greatness, of course, has never been recognized, people who've done so much for humanity by inventions and by skills, medical skills, many, many skills. We do really know what glory is. But I think what puzzles are the folk who've said that they haven't quite grasped the idea of glory is that they have an icon or an image of what glory is. And these various things don't fit that image. So they think, well, I don't know what glory is. But I think in all the human race, that our hearts are very deeply touched when we hear of people, and we don't mind naming many of them, like Mother Teresa and equivalent people who've done great things in the world, whether we look at it from a secular or a so-called spiritual point of view, we see people and we see the greatness. And one of the things which moves us is when a person will give his or her life for another person. I don't simply mean in war or in tragedy. That is wonderful too. But people who will devote their lives when they're not going to get anything from it other than giving the love that they give. I think all of us say that person is really a glorious person, no matter if their ordinary looks may be very, very ordinary, really. And so we do know what glory is and what greatness is. And somebody has said that it is in the process of worshipping God, when we are ascribing to him glory and honour and majesty and dominion and power and greatness, that we ourselves are uplifted, because we are, as it were, living in the very vibrations and resonations of glory itself. We are in that. And if there's hesitancy in our worship, and if we're drawing back, and of course our worship is not confined to what we would call an embodied corporate worship like we're having tonight, or may have on Sundays in our churches. Worship, the other word for worship is service. And we actually serve God when we worship him. And I was saying the other day that God really loves Thanksgiving. He just loves it. And you know, we saw the other night that when man did not glorify God and was not thankful, that seeing the glory of God and being thankful to God comes in the one breath. And so when you start to praise other people and to give thanks to them, and don't ever, you may find people who horrified if you thank them or praise them, and they've got something to learn too. There are some people who will give and give and give but will never receive, and it's like a circuit that's blocked up in one end. And as we give praise to God, there's a verse in Romans 4 which says that as Abraham gave praise to God, he grew in glory. Some translations put it the other way around, but it doesn't really matter. But I'm saying tonight, if you understand what glory is, look around here tonight. We have tremendous volume of glory in this meeting. And you would not have sung those last two songs, you wouldn't have sung them with all that emphasis and feeling, would you? Unless you knew and know He is glorious. So does that help in understanding the fact of glory? Don't try to designate it, don't try to form it and say that is glory and nothing else is glory. But just when you come across that glory, then immerse yourself in it. And you meet a good man or a good woman, then you meet somebody who has glory. I was telling them last night when we were boys, 15 years of age, and we were all very soundly converted. You can always think we're double converted. We were so converted. And we meet each other. Our first question would be, have you got any glory in your soul? I don't know how it all started. But we used to greet each other, if you've got any glory in your soul. I think probably one or two little tiny white lies were told on occasions when people didn't sense they had any glory in their soul. But it's not a bad question, is it? No. But don't ask it any longer. Yes, we shouldn't be expecting glory. Christians, should you? No, nothing like that. Now, if that's the first thing we can see, now I put the question to you. Do you have any glory in your soul? Well, you can't glorify unless you have glory, because your glorifying would be empty. When you see the greatness of God, we said before that when you glorify God as God, then you're not giving Him something He doesn't have, but you're giving Him something that, if I may use the term, He deserves. He is the great God, and to worship is one of the great gifts that God has given to His people. It's a gift to worship. I must admit, I'm not all that struck on having committees for worship. I don't want to say anything against them, but somehow or another, congregation is just there ready to be launched or to explode or whatever. There's worship enough in God's people wherever you go. When I ask if you've got any glory in your soul, what I meant is, are you a person who is not kacha, but pakka? Remember using those two terms last night? Kacha means green, raw, immature, unstable, incomplete. And pakka means strong, substantial, lasting, permanent, mature. I'm hoping that just talking like this will excite some people. They say, well, I would like to be. But there's something, and let me just tell you, that people who are getting old, or old as they say, older these days, they don't want to get younger. That is very interesting. And as a matter of fact, the top one is the one who's the oldest. Even if she's a little bit, you know what? Yeah, really something. You covered each year that God has given you and added to the glory that he's in. That's what I'm trying to say. That when you are mature, when you are pukka, when you are enriched, you've got glory. Now, what's the glory for? That's the big thing. And the glory is that you may be a wiser than you were, more mature, more understanding of the nature of God and the nature of man and the nature of creation, and that you may move in that usefully and richly in the whole of the society into which God has called you. Now, that's what it's all about. Some of us are early maturers and some of us are late maturers, and some, you know, the rest of the story, have wasted their lives. So we talked about, a person, a mother who may give her whole life, the husband and the wife ideally would give the whole life for that child who's perhaps maimed or handicapped in some certain ways, and it is love that is flowing out. And if that's not glory, I don't know what is glory. Now, the person we're going to talk about tonight is Moses, because it's always good to seat at home where there's a human being who can be a good example for us. And Moses was a man who had had every advantage in life. You remember that when he was born, in the old AV, I think it was called a proper child. A proper child. That's a term that's often used amongst our own indigenous people. That's not proper. Or that's not appropriate. You know, there's a that's right, isn't it? And it's a very strong word, and it means we have discerned and assessed the situation, and that is not proper, or we have, and that is proper. And I'm thinking of all the young people tonight, as well as the older ones, because you never age. You get older. This is what they're saying today, but you can't escape the fact you get older, but you don't necessarily feel older. That doesn't really interest you, most of you, but I find that's a wonderful experience to live in, that you don't feel old, but you just feel something more substantial is being added all the time. That's the best way I can put it, to see that. And when you're young, and I'm not using this as an opportunity to have a crack at the young people, but sometimes you have wonderful gifts of life and of abundancy and buoyancy and all of that, and you think anything goes, but you see it is what you actually receive and use from God that makes you to be what you will be. Does that figure? If Paul says in a general principle, if we sow to the flesh corruption, we shall of the flesh reap corruption, but if we sow to the Spirit, we shall of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And so your life in a good sense, in the very best sense, is an investment. All the gifts and graces God has given you, when they are all utilized, then something very, very wonderful builds up. There's a great French theologian who said that man is a vessel destined to be filled by God, and as he is filled, so he is expanded, and as he is expanded, so he is filled. Can you see that? You keep on expanding your capacity for receiving, and you do that by giving, and so you grow in that way. Now, some people who may have felt they've wasted their lives, I just say to you quickly, two verses that have always been rich in my mind. One is that he says, I'll restore the years of the locust to feed them. I'll restore the years of the locust to feed them. Never think that you've missed out, that it's too late, that you've blown it all, and you've wasted your life, because God can do in a flash what we maybe should have been doing over decades. I'll restore the years which the locusts have eaten. And the other one is that a bruised reed he will not break, and a smoking flax he will not quench. God is infinitely long in his compassion, and he waits. And he waits, and his moment comes, and then we are in the glory, if I can use that term. And you can see it in people's bodies, their faces, their demeanor. You can see them change from something that was empty and vapid and self-concerned and self-seeking into this, the glory of Christ within them. living in the glory of the Father as children of God and living in the glory of the Lord of glory, Christ, as his people and as his brethren, and being constantly filled every moment with the Spirit of glory, the Holy Spirit. So I hope that's helpful. Now we'll come and we'll look at this particular case of Moses being a proper child when he was born, and God had it that he was not going to be destroyed at that time, and they were killing the male Jewish babies. And then you remember that he went through a whole training in the king's palace, Pharaoh's palace, as the adopted son of the princess. So he was taught wonderful things, and those things we today go into secular education, which really shouldn't call it secular, but we can learn all sorts of wonderful things. We must never despise all that is available to us today, and it's enormous, the amount that's available. But he was trained in all the lore of Egypt, L-O-R-E, which meant its culture, but also the law of Egypt, because it was a very fine law. And then you remember that in his passion one day, he killed an Egyptian. And so he's a marked man. And he fled into the wilderness. He fled to the back of the desert, where the Midianites lived. And this great man, Jethro, he married Jethro's daughter. And Jethro was the priest of the Midianites, and a very pukka priest he was. He was a very mature, a very well-versed man, and he must have taught Moses so much. And so Moses was 80 years of age when he began his ministry, when he was called. But you remember, he had a sight of the glory. He saw this tree burning, and it wasn't burning, it was bright, flaming. And he went near it, it wasn't burning, and he thought he'd have a good look at this, and so I suppose he used a bit of his Egyptian science approach to it, how we sort of inquire into this strange thing. And he heard a voice saying, "Moses, the ground whereon you stand is holy. Take off your shoes." That's about the biggest lesson we learn. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. If you've never had fear of God, then I pity you, because your perspective will be totally wrong. That song we sang tonight, "The Lord reigneth, let the people tremble. He sitteth between the cherubim, let the earth be moved. The Lord reigns in Zion." How do the words go then? But anyway, it's a great and terrible is he. And I remember once, one Thursday morning, one of the members of our class objecting, saying, that's not a good word to use. And she suggested awesome. Well, it's a little bit difficult today to use that word, because young people have done things with it, and it doesn't really fit. Everything's awesome. If it's not awesome, it's cool. Which just goes to show the expanse of refrigeration throughout the world. But the fear, and now I said, no, leave that there. Leave that there. Don't ever take that word away. Don't ever translate it on what you call a dynamic equivalent, because you can't get a dynamic equivalent to terrible. God is terrible. And let's be sure, strike terror into our hearts. We were faced with God in a naked sort of a way. We would be fearfully frightened. And we've been talking about the fact of his glory and all the wonderful things of his glory. But he is a God whom we fear. And him whom we fear to disturb. We want to do it the way he wants us to do it. And there's something beautiful about fear. It's the beginning of wisdom. It says the fear of the Lord is a fountain of life. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. Now that's the side of his glory that we have to see. We're coming on to this passage we had read tonight. You may like to open it to Exodus 33 and then on to Exodus 34. And when Moses said to him, you remember what happened before, that when Moses was up in the mountain, the people came to Aaron and that thing went on and they brought in all the precious metals and so on, and they melted them down and they made this golden calf, which was an ox. That's what we're talking about in Psalm 106. They changed the glory of God to that of an ox that eats grass. And that's what they did. And they said, these are the gods, or this is our God, who brought us out of the land of Egypt. And they were saying, oh no, we believe in Yahweh, but he is like a great strong ox. He's stronger than others, and we want a strong God, and we've got a strong God. But it was idolatry. And we're going to have a look very quickly in a moment at the law of God, but really almost the first half of the law is talking against idolatry. It's talking for utter, pure worship of God, but it is talking against idolatry, the most dreadful thing. I mean, last night, David didn't laugh when I talked about his idol, and I thought a little pang hit my heart, and I thought, well, you can make fun, but don't make that kind of fun, really. It was only in fun that I said I didn't think he made it an idol at all. But an idol is a dreadful thing. If you were to get an Old Testament and go through it, and wherever idolatry is mentioned or stories of idol worship are mentioned or judgments, cut all that, you'd have a very minimized Old Testament. God is very concerned about idolatry. And we live in a materialistic society. And another word for materialism is idolatry. There can't be any doubt about that. So we live in danger of that all the time. So they made this idol. And then in chapter 32, if you just flip back to the moment, and the Lord said to Moses, verse 9, I've seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and that I may consume them. But of you I'll make a great nation. He was going to destroy the whole of Israel except Moses' family. But Moses besought the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does thy wrath burn hot against thy people, whom thou hast brought forth out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them forth, to slay them in the mountains, to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from thy fierce wrath and repent of this evil. Change your mind about this evil against the people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou didst swear by thine own self, and didst say to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, and all this land that I have promised I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do to his people. Well, I don't want to go into the apologetics of that tonight, but God certainly made a move which made Moses, all the love that Moses had for his people and all the faith that he had in God as the rock, come to the surface, and he felt he could speak strongly to God about it. And he stood in the breach. Otherwise, it appears, God would have destroyed the people. So when he comes to God after this event, he says to him, you have told me to take the people up to Canaan, but I have no guarantee that I would ever get them there. You said you'd do it, but I am afraid I do not have enough understanding of you and of what you're about, and you will just have to open up and show me all your glory. Every time we have an election for either Prime Minister or the local or the State Premier, we are always looking to see, is this man got any glory in him, aren't we? Come on. Is this man mature? Is this man wise? Is this man fatherly? Is this woman, now we're having leaders, women leaders, is this person able to get us to where they should want to get us? They never tell us where we're going to go anyway, but that doesn't matter. We just go, keep going. But do we not look for that? Now, I'm sure that when you come into worship, don't you look for a leader who is a man of the Holy Spirit, a man of God, a man of wisdom? Now, if you have true worship, nobody can hijack that. There must have been something missing for them to want to hijack it and then to hijack it. And whether that's a proper statement, again, I don't know. But what I'm saying is that to be worshipful people, we need to be mature people and to have mature leadership. Would you agree with that? Yes. And would you agree that it is not an easy thing today to be a father or to be a mother, to be a husband and a wife? Would you agree with that? Would you agree that we need extreme wisdom? I know you don't come ready-made as a mother or a father, that I know. It's a process, and it takes time, and you grow into it. You're bewildered often at first, or overconfident, or something, I don't know. How many people go into a marriage kutcher? Too many. I used to say to Laurel, I can tell you how long that marriage will last. You can pick out the difference between agape, God's love, and human love, eros, and all those things. So I'm saying, what we're talking about now is grist to our mill. Moses is easy to talk about, he's gone. But we are living in this situation. This is the generation that is calling on the glory of God in order to be established properly. And Moses says to God, you show me who you are, and then with all my heart I can understand and work on the basis of your glory. So now I want to just not diverge, it's still in the line of what we're talking about. Talk about moral glory. You've heard that term, haven't you? Moral glory. And you've heard the term which we brought in last night, substantial glory. Well, substantial glory, you see God here on the mountain with the Ten Commandments, and he is awesome in the good sense of the term, awesome. And you remember the clouds and the thunder and the lightning and the fire. All of that made the people afraid. And when God actually spoke, they said, we don't want to hear this voice. It was so terrifying that they didn't want to hear it. But in my lifetime, God has spoken to me and sent me into states of terror. And I have come out of those a better and a fresher and a more alive person. There's something, I was saying, that in Alzheimer's, the doctors are saying it's a kind of a plaque, you know, the sort of thing you get on your teeth and so on, that sort of thing that goes across the brain, and it gradually deadens the various centres and so on, memory and so on, plaque. And I think that the church shows all signs of being covered or being covered gradually and subtly with plaque. Start it ourselves. What is the most glorious thing to us? What is that in which we glory today and for which we're thankful? I say no more than that. You're all intelligent people. And you know that those great ways in which people were gripped by the love of God and the power of God and wanted to win the world for him, however much that may have been off key here and there, still was true. Burning for God. But the plaque, we can just so domesticate the body of Christ. Sure, we are domestic people. We're under the Father and his Son and our brother and But to domesticate a thing is to take the life out of it and make it handleable, so to speak. We can handle it. And so we want to see that God's moral glory, and I did explain a little bit last night, and others have talked about it, that God's characteristics or elements or whatever you may call them, attributes of holiness, righteousness, goodness, truth, love, they are not negative, they're not abstract qualities. They are dynamically operating. Find a righteous man or a righteous woman, a good man or a good woman. I don't mean a goody good man or a goody good woman. Meet a person of love and you see those moral powers operating. You say, this is a strong, strong person. Even though they may be physically almost weak beyond description, something emanates. Now, the mistake we can make is that when I say to you that the law of God is the law by which God works himself, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are a community, they are utterly, utterly one in a way which we can't even properly imagine, certainly can't describe, and the law that they have is that they don't have a law which they obey, it's over them and they obey, but it is the law of the way they are. Can you see that? Well, you know Laurel and me fairly well now, and you know we have a lot of fun, and you know how obedient I am to Laurel, and how sometimes she is to me, and you know, or you know us very well, some of you do anyway, and you know that's the kind of law, the way we are. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? Well, that's the way God is, and we would never know unless he told us what it was. When he created us in his image, he implanted it in our hearts. That's the way we are, right down at core, bottom, that's how we are. Because we are in the image and glory of God. So his law is just the way he is, and who can object to the way he is? But when I say that, you'll say, oh yes, but the law says thou shalt and thou shalt not. So it means I've got to not do this and I've got to do that. And that's going to be a big battle. Well, you see, that's where you're stupid. Let me say it. It's not a battle to obey the law. It's a battle to disobey it. You're fighting against the way you've been constituted by God in creation. And if you'd let go and live under the law, then you would find the serenity and the peace and the richness of being a human being and growing. That's what you discover. And then the law would be wonderful. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul or restoring the soul. You go on to one. And I heard when we came tonight, we were singing, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me. Were you singing that tonight? Some of you are late, you wretches. And the others who came early, you heard, surely goodness and mercy. And I used to think of goodness and mercy are like two dogs, you know, that followed you. Goodness and, you're looking around and, you know, heel, heel, you know. But goodness and mercy is God in his goodness, God in his mercy, who will never let us go. He'll pursue us till the last moment. For our good and our protection. So I would love to go on with that about the law. But please keep it in mind that when we're talking about God's moral being, what we really mean is not that he is a goody-goody, doesn't do anything wrong, and not if we obey the law, we're goody-goodies. We're not goody-goodies. We need grace every moment of life. And we need the grace of law every moment of life. But it means that you make a decision. People get terribly upset about you and you say, the Lord has predestined some to eternal life, don't they? Because they immediately get on the side of those who haven't been predestined, which is just an expression of their anger and their rebellion. That's all. If the Bible says it, that's so. So relax, believe it and get on with it. And don't have big discussions on predestination. Cut amongst the pigeons? Well, let the pigeons fly. But let's get on. You see, because the law of God is the glory of God. It said that man is the living personal image of God, but the law is the written preceptual image of God. God has given it to us in form. Amongst our indigenous people, the law is never written. It is never written. It dare not be written. For reasons that they were given, it has to be handed down by the word of mouth. And you know that God gave that originally as soft copy, not as hard copy. He spoke it. It was so frightening when he spoke it. It would be more frightening if it had never been spoken and if we didn't have it written. Now, am I in a spot of difficulty at the moment? Are you reacting because you heard that grace finishes law forever? Ha, 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 I say. What a strange thing. From now on, God is lawless, so we can be lawless. Oh, no. The law is the most beautiful gift that he gives us. He said, do you want to know how to live? Come along and I'll show you. That's the way I live. And do you want to have that secret given to you, how to live? Well, take up my law. I think it's marvelous. Because, you see, God has will and he chooses, and his will is to create a humanity which is so much like him that it couldn't be any more like him than it will be. And to create an Eden which will be so much like his Eden, his eternal temple, his sanctuary, that it couldn't be any more like. And to create a whole creation that is virtually Eden, and a whole new people who are virtually the very sons and daughters of God himself. Well, that's what he's about. And the way to live in that is to walk in his law and do his commandments. So don't get the idea, that legal idea. You know what I'm talking about, the legal idea. Just get the functional idea. The way to live and to function in this world. If you get hold of that, then I tell you, you've got great, great pastures in front of you. You've got an enormous verdancy to traverse in your lifetime. Now, you see, if you see God's substantial glory, his authority, his majesty, he is the great and terrible God, and you see all of that, that's very salutary. That keeps you sane. Am I right? We've only started. You won't fit it all on the cassette. Well, we must honour people for time and that sort of thing. I want to do that. Just let me finish this little section as quickly as possible. When Moses came to God and said, I want to know all your glory, he didn't have an idea that God was a cruel, vengeful lawgiver who was always on people and, you know, had a spiritual CID, making sure they did the right thing and didn't do the wrong thing and so on and so on. And he said, look, I can't show you all my glory or you'd perish, but I'll show you these things. First of all, he said, I'll make all my goodness pass before you. I've asked people today, how are you? Oh, I'm good, thank you. And then some of those real good Christians, you know, said, there's no one good but God. Well, Christ said that, didn't he? No one good but God. Suppose you want man to say, well, then you are good, so you must be God. Or you might, that's me, might already be what he meant to say. I don't know. But today when we say good, we mean I'm okay, right? So we're not getting a bit meticulous about the theology of it. But God's goodness is not the fact that he's goody good, that he doesn't do anything wrong, he does everything right. But his goodness is his goodness, is his goodness. How good The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord. A good man is one whom God has accepted, whom God has justified, whom God has called, whom God has regenerated. And he says, I'll pass all my goodness, fancy seeing all the goodness of the Lord, and I will be great, and he says, and I'll proclaim before you my name. Now, we could take a whole summer school on the name. We really could, and we'd never exhaust it. For God to show his name, to proclaim his name, is to proclaim his character, his being, his authority. Everything about himself is his name. And he said, and I'll be gracious. And I will be gracious to him, I'll be gracious, and I'll show mercy to him, I'll show mercy. Let me ask you, has God shown you grace in your lifetime? Has he? Are you grateful? And has he had mercy on you? You know, when we were dead in trespasses and sins, when we walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of Jesus, but God, out of his great love for us, his great mercy for us. We should resonate with that, shouldn't we? That's what I'll show you, Moses. And then when Moses is hidden by the hand of the Lord, as he comes to him to show him his grace, the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, Yahweh, Yahweh, and all that that means in the name. A God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. I keep wanting to mouth these over, you know, like cumins, you know. Get some more from it all the time. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping, oh, surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life. Never lets up, does he? He's not good and merciful if you call on him. That's the way he is. Keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. That's why we talk about his moral glory. You see that? He who is morally perfect, who does not do good, does not do evil, is not just legalistically righteous, but with all the warmth that all of those things convey to us, and he says, merciful, gracious, slow to anger, doesn't have a short fuse. Some of us think he does. Abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, faithfulness. We sang that tonight. Ascribe greatness to the God, our rock. Just and faithful is he. Keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who by no means clear the guilty. Oh. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children's children, the third and fourth generation, and Exodus tells us, 20 tells us that of them that hate me, the generations of them that hate me. Oh. But you see, one side of him is compassionate and forgiving and forgives the sins of thousands of generations of sin and iniquity and rebellion. He forgives all of that, all of that, all of that. You're sitting here tonight, and all your sins are forgiven. All your iniquity is pardoned. All your pollution is purified. You are sitting here tonight glowing in the glory God has given you through that cross. Are you not? That's his moral glory. So you see, if you and I are going to be people of moral glory, we are going to be just that. We are going to be people with long fuses and not short fuses, if I could put it that way. Love is not suspicious. Love is kind. Love is gentle. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. I took a long time getting to here, and I feel sort of in a sense guilty for not having done it better, never mind. But what I was going to talk about was that man Moses, who so loved his people that he stood up to God for them. Do you know that? Ostensibly they could have been destroyed, but he stood up and he loved them. But there came an experience in his life. I remember once when they were, and I'll have to close it off with this, that he stood up once before the people, and they were whinging and wailing, and they really were a bunch of whingers, you've got to grant that. They never saw the big picture like he did, you see. And they said, it better you left us in Egypt where we could have worked here, but we'd have got water and food and that sort of thing. And they whinged and wailed, and God said to them, don't say that. Just speak. He said, take your rod and hit the rock. That was a place called Meribah or Massa. And years later they came back to that place. You remember when he hit the rock, that the water flowed out? Remember that? And then years later they came back, and they were roughly around the same place. Leave it to all the experts to talk that one out. But virtually it was a repeat of that situation. And there they were really whinging and wailing about the fact they didn't have any. God said, well, he said, speak to the rock. He didn't say hit the rock. He said, speak to the rock. And Moses and Aaron were furious. They got up, grim visage, these old men. And Moses takes up his rod and to the rock. There, you rebels, he said. God said, for that, Moses, because you failed to sanctify me in the eyes of the people, I will not allow you to take the people into the promised land. Love. The old AV used to have love is not easily provoked. The Greek actually has love is not provoked. I suppose even the translators thought, then come the raw prawn. Love is not provoked. But love was provoked at Meribah. The people contended with God. And Moses, we would understand, because some of us don't have all that long a fuse either. Some write, but God said, no, I'm a God who's merciful, slow to anger, long-suffering, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. They're my people, I love them, and I will see them, whinges or not, through to the glorious end. And Moses said, he said, Moses, when you stood up and you did that, would they believe in my glory when you are my servant and they know that I speak with you face to face? Now that's moral glory. It's not just being right and meticulously correct with the law. It is saying that that law is the way of life. And Jesus said, Jesus said to the multitude one day when he was talking about the Pharisees, and he was really, really talking about them that day. And he said these words, and this is on which I close. I mean now, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, the primary matters of the law, that means, the matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. Surely goodness and mercy. What are the primary things of the law, this law which we take so hard? There they are. Justice and mercy and faithfulness. That's moral glory. That's what makes a mum and a dad and whoever, and an aunt or somebody, take a little child who has virtually been vetoed almost to death or whatever, neglect, and give a whole life of devotion. And I know you all know those experiences. You've had them in your lives, and you recognize them in others, and you thank God that this world is not as the cynics see it at all. We seek great glory, great, great glory in one another. But we are destined, that's our destiny, to be glorified. And we'll talk about that much more tomorrow night. We'll close with number 30 in the Red Books.